Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Polarization is undermining democratic institutions. Science and reason are under siege. All of this is eroding trust between people and democratic leaders and institutions.
The two-day virtual summit for democracy wraps up on Friday in Washington.
The court has taken the custom of hearing the lawyers and the accused late at night or really early in the morning, which is unfair on them and which is unfair and undue process. So this is why I decided not to participate to that.
The defense attorney for a key opposition leader is calling for international intervention to stop what he says is the persecution of Riki Madugu by authorities in Benin.
We are getting travelers from all over the country and therefore want to assure the world that nobody should change his or her itinerary when he's coming to the country, because the risk has been tremendously reduced. You can come to Uganda, carry out your business without the very big risk of catching COVID-19.
And a top Ugandan official says travel bans by Western countries against African countries are unfortunate. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. As the two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to monitor and restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. The U.S. is also launching programs to support independent media and anti-corruption efforts and defend free and fair elections. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara has more.
From robots patrolling behavior, facial recognition surveillance, to software that turns phones into spying devices. Such technology is often used by governments to target political opponents, activists, journalists, and minority groups.
We focused on the need to empower human rights defenders and make sure technology enables so much of our lives that is used to advance democracies, to lift people up, not to hold them down.
As the two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We've seen the expanded misuse of spyware and other surveillance technology to monitor citizens far beyond what's needed to fight the virus. We've seen the rapid spread of disinformation and misinformation.
The U.S. also announced initiatives to empower human rights defenders, support free and fair elections, independent media, and anti-corruption efforts. Transparency International, a global civil society organization working in the fight against corruption, said the summit's initial outcomes are promising, but more needs to be done. Gary Kalman directs their U.S. office.
Other countries did not step up and commit to specific commitments the way the U.S. has. And so that is a concern. What are they actually going to come up with? They have a little bit more time. The U.S. government's giving them until January to come back with commitments.
Some say the $424 million in U.S. funds for these initiatives, still subject to congressional approval, barely meets the need to bolster democracy globally. Brett Bruin is director of global engagement during the Obama administration and president of the consulting firm Global Situation Room.
These are initiatives and monies that have been allocated already generally for democracy, for the rule of law and human rights. They get to repurpose them for a new announcement. But what we're not seeing here are really substantial sums that are being put on the table.
Democracy is also under attack by the global rise of populism, white supremacy, and extremism, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Polarization is undermining democratic institutions. Science and reason are under siege. All of this is eroding trust between people and democratic leaders and institutions.
An in-person summit is planned a year from now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
In Benin, the defense attorney for a key opposition leader is calling for international intervention to stop what he says is the persecution of Rekia Madugu by authorities. Antoine Vey also says he is stepping away from the trial of Ms. Madugu to protest his concerns over the court's ability to remain independent and to ensure fairness. This after telling local media that charges against Ms. Madugu and a subsequent trial are politically motivated. The opposition leader has been sentenced to 20 years in prison after the court found her guilty of the charges against her. Ms. Madugu, the leader of the opposition, the Democrats Party, was arrested in March and was charged with several offenses, including the financing of terrorism and planning to assassinate several political figures. Her party and other civil society and opposition groups condemned the charges as politically motivated, an accusation the government sharply denies. But supporters of the administration accuse the opposition leader of threatening national security. Meanwhile, defense attorney Antoine Vey tells me that the trial of the Beninese opposition leader fails to meet both local and international judicial standards.
From the beginning, we said that it was not a trial, which would be the part of a legal process, but it is only a political persecution, aiming at unjailing political opponents. So, unfortunately, this morning we had many illustrations on what we have been fighting for weeks now. So, we decided to leave the courtroom in order to show our protest. And we hope that this political persecution will soon come to an end.
I understand you have quit the trial. What informed your decision to take such an action?
I know from the beginning that this court has been precisely instaurated in order to get rid of political opponents. Rekia Madugu is not the first one who has been unjailed, unfortunately. Other has been exiled. So I told the court that they showed no guarantee in terms of independence and impartiality. And as I noticed that they would carry on with the trial, I decided to leave the courtroom.
Where does this leave Rekia Madugu?
She is still represented by a local counsel there in order to reply to the question of the judges. But my point of view is that I did not want to caution by my participation this process. I don't think it is legal. I don't think it is fair. And this is why I decided to kick. Then her, she doesn't have the choice. She's there. She's unjailed. And she will reply to the judges. And, well, you can always dream of having a good decision. And we will see that tonight.
Are you therefore saying that the decision has been predetermined?
Yes, yes. This is exactly the reason why I decided not to participate. It is written from the beginning and it is only a political process. So I'm not a politician. I'm not someone who play in a theater. I'm a lawyer. And if I'm not feeling that we are before a court of law, I thought it wasn't my role to be on a side.
Some people are saying that questioning judicial independence in this trial basically undermines the judicial independence in Benin.
Well, all the international observers in the past years have been denunciating very strongly the retrieve of freedom of expression in Benin. Many journalists have been incarcerated. Many opponents have been incarcerated or exiled. Many candidates to the last presidential election were not able to run for presidency because of the modification of law. Therefore, yes, we are in an illustration once more that the fact that freedom is not the main consideration of the current president at the moment. And unfortunately, we thought that it wasn't necessary for us to give rise to this kind of image.
There are suggestions that because of the charges she faces, including terrorism, there could be a heavy sentence, including probably 20 or more years in jail. But can you talk about the possible sentence if she's found guilty?
Well, to be quite frank, I don't want to reply to this question because I don't think that Mr. Madugu has anything to do in jail or in a process involving a criminal matter. So Once again, it's just a masquerade, a mask that has been put on a political decision that was taken long before this trial even started. Everything had been written from the beginning, and nowadays we are just in a new illustration of this whole process. So this is why we are asking for support on international level. We are asking for support from the public opinion here in Benin in order for the political persecution to cease.
So apart from this trial, you will still represent Reki Amadugu as a lawyer, but not for this particular trial, correct?
No, I represented her, and we decided that it was not fair, it was not equitable, and therefore that there was no use for her to have a lawyer within this kind of debate that was going on. It's not done according to the law, and therefore what's the point of arguing in law when the judges are not there to judge in law? And one of the many difficulties that we underlined was that the fact that his defense was not able to act properly. We had the case yesterday night. We were unable to quote witnesses. We were unable to prepare his defense properly. And the court has taken the custom of hearing the lawyers and the accused late at night or really early in the morning, which is unfair on them, and which is unfair and undue process. So this is why I decided not to participate to that.
Antoine Vey is the defense attorney for Benin opposition leader Reki Amadugu. He spoke with me from the capital, Cotonou. In Uganda, the Minister of Information, Communications, Technology and National Guidance says travel bans imposed by Western countries against African countries are unfortunate. Dr. Chris Bariamunsi, an epidemiologist and public health expert, says travel restrictions imposed on African countries are not based on science. His comments come after wealthy nations imposed travel restrictions on some African states. The move followed the announcement by South African authorities that the Omicron variant of COVID had been discovered in the country. Critics say it is typical of the Western approach towards Africa throughout the pandemic, including the hoarding of vaccines and other preventive measures to fight the disease. But supporters of the travel restrictions say it gives Western countries time to study the new variant and implement measures to contain it. For more reaction to the travel restrictions and Uganda's efforts to limit the spread of the coronavirus, I reached Dr. Chris Bariamunsi via Skype. With the Ugandan government implementing strategies and medical measures to contain the disease, what is the progress report in the fight to contain the coronavirus in Uganda at the moment? Because I understand there were certain measures that were implemented, including local remedies, among other issues.
Yes, we've made progress. You know, we are among the countries which were hit hard by this COVID-19, but initially we mounted lockdowns and other restrictive measures at the height of the second wave, which we experienced between May, June, July this year. We registered very high positivity rates. Our positivity rate was as high as 21%, but we have since then had a successful response to the extent that we are now registering positivity rates of less than 1%, and the situation has improved. And we are opening the space. We had closed schools. We are now going to open them. We have, like I said earlier on, subjected every incoming traveler to mandatory testing for COVID-19. So the situation has greatly improved. Right now, we have a huge campaign to vaccinate all those eligible Ugandans. We have made provision for enough resources to bring in vaccines, but the donations which we are receiving, now we have enough vaccines to vaccinate everybody who is above 18 years. So now the campaign which is on in Uganda is to mobilize Ugandans to embrace vaccination. We have vaccinated up to 6% of the population, but going forward, we think in the next like 2 or 3 months, we should be able to have vaccinated a substantial proportion of our people, and then we can open fully our economy and the space in Uganda.
Talking about vaccination, what is the cooperation between Uganda and its neighbors?
you know, with a common strategy to contain the disease and vaccinate people, educate people not to engage in vaccine apathy, and then having enough resources of the vaccines available for the arms of Ugandans and East Africans, if I may.
Yes, we have collaborative activities within the East African community, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, South Sudan, the neighboring countries. We are collaborating on messages, on mobilizing the people, but also on procurement for vaccines. So there is that strong collaboration. And also we do some of these procurements through African Union. So there is a collaboration, and we are speaking together and speaking the same language across the East African sub-region.
So what assurances are you giving the people of Uganda and for those who will be visiting Uganda about the measures that are being implemented to contain or limit the spread of the coronavirus, and that when they come or visit Uganda, they might not run into problems of getting easily infected with the coronavirus and its variants in Uganda?
Yes, the assurance that we give our listeners and viewers that we have managed to contain the COVID-19. There is no reason whatsoever why anybody would fear or should fear to come to this country. We continue to promote public health prevention measures like putting on masks, hand washing, or using a sanitizer, avoiding congregations and ensuring there is physical distancing. Vaccination drive is on, and we test everybody who comes into the country without inconveniencing the person, because when you test, we allow you to proceed to your hotel, and then the results follow you. If you test positive, you are managed by our professionals. So we are managing very well. And the tourism industry has since come back. We are getting travelers from all over the country, and therefore want to assure the world that nobody should change his or her itinerary when he's coming to the country, because the risk has been tremendously reduced. You can come to Uganda, carry out your business without a very big risk of catching COVID-19.
Dr. Chris Bayomunsi is the Ugandan Minister of Information, Communications Technology and National Guidance and an epidemiologist and public health expert. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu Hassan is scheduled to open a national political dialogue with stakeholders next week. The Political Parties Council, which organized the forum, says its meeting on December 16 and 17 will help resolve sharp differences between the police and political parties. But the main opposition party, Chadema, and ACT Wazalendo, say they will boycott the meeting. They say major concerns of the opposition will not be discussed at the forum, including demands for a new constitution and the use of the police and state institutions to undermine freedom of expression and assembly. They also say the ruling party has narrowed political space, making it difficult for the opponent of the administration to freely engage with supporters. They cite the recent arrest of chairman of Chadema, Freeman Mbowe, as an example of the state's use of the police to intimidate and harass opponents. But supporters of the ruling party dismiss the accusation. They contend that the government has the mandate to arrest and prosecute people who violate the law and who threaten the country's security and territorial integrity. For more on the opposition party's boycott and what it means for the country's political climate, I reach Faraja Lugumi, lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Chadema and ACT, they haven't indicated to be ready to attend the meeting. They have said they are going to boycott the meeting because of the current situation in Tanzania, that political parties are not free to practice politics in our country, and especially during this time when the national chairperson of Chadema, Freeman Mbowe, who is now in the police custody, he is accused of planning for the terror attacks in our country. So Chadema and ACT are saying there's no fair ground for political practices in our country. So they say they are not going to attend the meeting since the president has not shown any clear intention of creating a fair environment of doing politics in our country.
Some Tanzanians are saying this will be a missed opportunity for ACT Wazalendo
as well as Chadema to boycott this meeting, especially when Chadema has written to the president seeking for a meeting. What is your take on that?
Yes, this is a missing opportunity. However, they have their reason. What they are saying is the case against Freeman Mbowe is more political than a crime, as they are saying, because Mbowe has never been a terrorist, and there's no any reason to link the case with terror threat that is linked to Mbowe. And so Chadema has been calling upon for a long time that the president should intervene on this case. They wrote a letter to the president expressing their interest to meet her. Unfortunately, she never replied to their letter. And with that, they don't believe that the president has any intention to hold talks. And in fact, what is behind all this is the campaign of Chadema about reviving the writing of the new constitution.
But Faraja, can't they raise their issues at the stakeholders forum where the president will be and perhaps, as some people say, confront her with the facts and allow the chips to fall where they may?
Peter, I think the question here is not the president to be confronted with the truth. The question here is that will the president be ready to betray the position of the ruling party on the issue of new constitution? Because the decision of the ruling party in 2015 might not be her own decision, might be the position of the ruling party. So she might be confronted by the two pressures, the public and the pressure from her own party. And the best thing that she could do is to comply with the decision or the position of the ruling party, which has put her in power, rather than betraying her political party. I think she would opt for betraying the interests of the public.
What then is the significance of this meeting, and will its objective be achieved with these two major political parties with a lot of supporters boycotting it?
In fact, Peter, there will be no any significance of the meeting if the two political parties, especially ACT and Chadema, which have many followers or members, will boycott the meeting. It means the meeting will have no significance. The reason why I'm saying there will be no significance is because these are the political parties that have many followers. The parties that have confirmed to attend the meeting do not have followers, and they have no significance in the Tanzanian political landscape. So it is like a president will be making a statement to the political parties that have no any political power or any political influence in our country. So there will be no significance if these two major political parties will boycott the meeting. In fact, it's like the meeting will have no impact to our political situation in our country.
Faraja Lugume is lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Hello, this is James Barton, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says its newly elected leaders will lead it to victory in the next general election. This after its members elected Iyochi Aiyu as national chairman. Aiyu, a former Senate president, was the PDP's consensus candidate at its recent national convention in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. He garnered 3,426 out of the 3,511 accredited votes, representing more than 95% of the total vote cast. Kola Ologbodiyan, the outgoing spokesperson of the party, says its new leaders will come up with winning strategies that will help it wrest power from the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC, under President Muhammadu Buhari. He also says growing insecurity and the myriad of challenges facing the country show it's heading in the wrong direction. But critics say the PDP and its policies failed to attract voters in the last polls, which they contend enabled incumbent President Buhari to win re-election. They expressed doubt the PDP can win back power in 2023. For more reaction about the election of the new leadership of Nigeria's main opposition party, I reached the group's outgoing spokesperson, Kola Ologbodiyan.
What the expectations of Nigeria from the PDP is that the party gets stronger and become more viable for the purpose of rescuing power from the government that is in different.
Bakola, some people are expressing concern that perhaps the PDP is bedeviled by infighting and court cases and may not be strategically placed to wrestle power from the ruling party in the next general election. How do you respond to that?
So that is totally incorrect. And I say it's totally incorrect because the constitution of the People's Democratic Party, as amended in 2017, has given power to the members and leadership of the party on how to manage the affairs of the party and keep it alive, purposes of contesting and winning elections. The issues of matters being in court are also product of democratic process. And as far as the People's Democratic Party is, as we speak currently, we have started the handing over process, made bare the activities that is conducted, and how it manages the affairs of the party. And the incoming leadership of the party, thereby creating a seamless process of transition of power, which is an embodiment of democratic norms. So we are talking about court processes as being as a possibility of being an inhibition for the party to achieve purpose ahead of 2023, I think they have a misplaced conception.
How do you respond to those who are of the view that the PDP has yet to officially come up with pragmatic measures that will rival or solve the myriad of problems Nigerians are facing, including insecurity?
The People's Democratic Party was voted for by Nigerians in the 2019 election. Because it was clear, as at the time election was held in 2019, that the All Progressive Congress and President Muhammadu Buhari are leading this on a journey to nowhere. And it was clear, and massively so, to Nigerians. And because of that, they bought into the programs of the People's Democratic Party. Nigerians also know, and they can recall, that the economic process which the People's Democratic Party utilized from 1999 to 2019 was the best for the country because there was generally an improvement. And Nigerians also know that in 2016, President Muhammadu Buhari came to office. The economy of the country had been in shambles. The anti-corruption process has failed. And that was the agitation across the country ahead of the 2019 election. So it is strange for anybody to say that no pragmatic steps were taken.
So what is the major takeaways from this transition to a new group of people that will be leading the PDP
The major takeaway is that the People's Democratic Party, unlike the party that forms government currently, has the capacity and the wherewithal to manage its own affairs. It is disgraceful that a party in government cannot conduct ordinary World Congress, and that all the congresses that they have had have resorted to all manner of crises and cost for all to the New Democratic Party. Yes, there are tons of bordering on contestation so far, but at the end of it all, the party is able to manage its affairs and come out as a one united political party.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the outgoing spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Amnesty International says atrocities committed in South Sudan over the last few months during its ongoing conflict could amount to war crimes. This was contained in the International Rights Organization's recently released human rights report. It documented, quote, unimaginable violence and atrocities committed against unarmed civilians that left dozens dead and tens of thousands displaced from their homes in parts of the country, including West Equatoria State and the Tambora region. Dipros Muchena is Amnesty International's director for East and Southern Africa. He says the international community, including the UN and regional bodies like the African Union, should step up effort to end the conflict. He also says there must be an independent investigation into the atrocities being committed in South Sudan. He tells me that the International Criminal Court, or ICC, should investigate the violence and hold those responsible accountable for the actions.
We have documented that between June and October this year, local groups which were affiliated to the army on the one side and the armed opposition on the other waged what we call the campaign of terror upon civilian population of the Bala and Agazande communities in the Tambaru County in West Equatoria. When Amnesty International researchers visited this area in the immediate aftermath, we documented a range of human rights violations and possibly war crimes. And they ranged from abductions, unlawful killings, and other civilian harm that were reported to us by survivors, looting and destruction of homestays, of property and houses, as well as displacement and humanitarian crisis that affected more than 80,000 people and created quite a dire crisis within the context of this violence that we recorded.
All these happening in spite of the several peace agreements signed between President Salva Kiir and the South Sudanese government in Juba and his main rival, Dr. Riek Machar, since 2018?
Yes, despite all that you have stated, the fighting still took place. And as you know, there is this issue of trying to locate this in the context of intercommunal violence. But as you know, both the Balanda and Azande communities have lived side by side for quite some period of time and have been intermarried. So the attacks really went beyond that. It was politicians wiping up ethnic hatred and ethnic mobilization in order to ensure that they achieve a political objective. We interviewed over 76 sources, including the people internally displaced, the humanitarians. We interviewed government officials, activists, and others. And it was clear that ethnically mixed survivors who had been forced to flee and were actually sheltering now in nearby Wau, Yambi, and Tambaru towns, the previous episode of the violence confirmed all these cases.
So these basically rise to the level of war crimes that possibly could be looked into by the International Criminal Court?
Yes, because they are possibly war crimes, because this is organized, uniformed men killing unarmed civilians, violating international law, and committing acts of arson, including looting, burning, and ensuring that crops that could no longer be harvested were left unharvested due to the insecurity of the area.
Dupros, what are the kinds of violations that Amnesty International is referring to
particularly in this case?
Okay, so survivors told us of harrowing accounts of escaping indiscriminate gunfire that lasted for hours, and of entire neighborhoods being set alight, or of seeing their relatives or neighbors shot to death, or fighters slitting their throats, stray bullets landing in homes and IDP shelters, civilians being injured in the process, including we recorded a case of a 10-year-old girl. Then we've got cases of hunger or inadequate shelter being forced on civilians out of their hiding places, and at times, you know, as they leave hiding places to go search for food, leading them to their deaths at the hands of fighters. And then, you know, armed men also ransacked, looted health facilities, depriving civilians of crucial care and violating international law. So our calls in the context of this is that the government of South Sudan really must expedite reconstruction efforts, because there have been tremendous loss that I have just described. We have made a second call being to facilitate the assistance and provision of essential services for the hugely displaced persons, then establish conditions for their safe, voluntary, and sustainable return. It's important they are reconnected with where they live, where they come from, for cultural and other reasons. And the last call we have made on the government is to ensure that those responsible for war crimes and other violations are held to account in competent courts under fair trial. We've proceeded to make a call on the international community, because there is, as you know, an important role for the international community. One is that the United Nations Security Council really should ensure that the arms embargo imposed on the territory of South Sudan in 2018 is renewed, because you've got this incident of arms moving around into wrong hands and creating everybody into a fighter. The African Union Commission itself and the government must establish the hybrid court of South Sudan, because we've spoken about this hybrid court for South Sudan for quite some time. There has been no movement beyond the cabinet process of declaring intention to begin. These are the calls that we have made both to the South Sudan government as well as to the international community.
Dipros Muchena is Amnesty International's director for East and Southern Africa. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Still in South Sudan, this century, a U.S.-based investigative and policy team has welcomed penalties against companies linked to President Salva Kiir's inner circle. This after the U.S. Department of the Treasury sanctioned two companies linked to businessman Benjamin Ball Mel, a close associate of the president who is receiving the same punishment. They were imposed by the Treasury Department Office of Foreign Assets Control as global Magnitsky designations, which target serious human rights abuse and corruption. For more reaction, I reach Justina Godowski, Director of Illicit Finance Policy at the Sentry. She says, quote, the designations demonstrate that efforts at sanction evasion, such as registering new companies to receive non-competitive and lucrative U.S. dollar-dominated government contracts, will not go unnoticed. She adds that coming on International Anti-Corruption Day, the Department of the Treasury should be commended for highlighting actors that extract unfair gains at the expense of the people of South Sudan.
It's a very positive reaction. These two companies in South Sudan are linked to Ball Mill, who was previously sanctioned. And these designations show a persistence on behalf of the Treasury Department that sanctions evasion will not be tolerated. And you can try to evade sanctions by registering new companies, but OFAC will find out about it and take action. So it's very positive. You know, sometimes sanctions can be like a game of whack-a-mole where, you know, a person, a company is sanctioned and they just go away and incorporate a new company. And that is a very common way to evade sanctions. So I think this is a very positive development, because it sends the message that you can't simply avoid sanctions by, you know, having proxies or incorporating new companies.
Well, the Sentry has been campaigning for sanctions to be imposed on these individuals and their companies for a while now. What does this mean for you?
I think it shows the cooperation under a global Magnitsky sanctions program under which these sanctions were issued, which, you know, the statute itself says that the U.S. government should consider information submitted by civil society. So it shows this very important cooperation between the civil society groups, of which Sentry is one of, but there are also others, and the Treasury Department and State Department on sanctions. As you know, a country like South Sudan, this is a place that probably does not get as much as attention as it deserves. So civil society organizations like the Sentry, you know, are able to devote resources to investigate corruption and human rights abuses in those countries, and share that information with the public, including the U.S. government. And you probably saw the alert we published about these companies, you know, fairly recently.
Will this ever serve as a deterrent?
I think so, yes, because it shows, again, that if you engage in corruption, if you steal from the people, you know, there will be action. And especially this is important because a lot of the international commerce, and specifically with South Sudan, is done in the U.S. dollars. So now these countries, I mean, sorry, these companies are shut out from the U.S. dollar, right? They cannot trade in the U.S. dollar because U.S. dollar transactions would have to go through a U.S. bank. So there would be U.S. jurisdiction. So it really shows, again, and I think, you know, sometimes sanctions are one-off designations and, you know, that have very little impact. But when you go after the economic actors, when you go after actors that import and export and deal in the U.S. dollars, that can really have an impact because they can no longer conduct that business, that international business. So I think that's why it's a deterrent. It shows other business persons that if they engage in corruption, their access to the U.S. dollar and international markets will be cut off.
What do you say to critics who are of the opinion the sanctions are unfair and appear to be targeting companies of individuals who are close advisors or who have close relations with the South Sudanese president?
Well, you know, Bolnell was targeted for corruption. So don't engage in corruption and you won't be targeted, right? And there are also ways to get off the sanctions list. If you stop your corrupt activities, you can petition OFAC and get off the list. So I think, you know, the Global Magnitsky Sanctions Authority is a very important one because it targets corrupt actors around the world, actors that, you know, get preferential treatment that robs the people of the necessary resources. So stop the corruption and the sanctions won't happen.
What is Sentry's message to the people of South Sudan following these imposed sanctions by the U.S. administration?
The message is that we support the South Sudanese people and that we want them to have the best future they can and to be able to use the wealth of the country should go to the people, not, you know, cronies with political influence.
Justina Gatsowski is the director of illicit finance policy at the Sentry. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Yeah. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. My girl, when he mak tata, body mak tata, maya. Hey, but I'm dogo many kama town, and he chase like I'm a character. Yeah, tulikutana kule Cape Cape Town, paka Accra Town, downtown. Hey, eti unasifa za kudanga na mengu anasema sijauna. Wivu umewaingia, ungu karionyesha ishara. Ndege wanashangilia, na nitakupeleka Ulaya. Wivu umewaingia, ungu karionyesha ishara. Ndege wanashangilia, na nitakupeleka Ulaya. Wakiniona na chofanya mi wandogo bwana mdogo wandogo nikitemo na shiba wandogo bwana mdogo wandogo Kilimanjaro na panda mi wandogo bado bwana mdogo wandogo
People never let me vex, make a boss gone. For my baby girl, I no go calm down. This is real loving, man, no be just fun. So Mr. Hater, man, better just shun. Sweet lover, you got that text from your lover, man. He won't caress ya. See you later, on the red dress. Bedroom bully girl, me wanna dress ya. Yeah. Go do. Yeah, them my link, but me not send them. Oh no no. Anybody hating girl, I'm friend them. Go do. Make we use this loving girl, offend them. Oh no no. If them no send us, we no send them. Ooh. Baby, yeah, just run to me now. I'm in love, but you give it to me now.
Wakiniona unanita
Bwa mdogo
Bwana mdogo
Bwa mdogo
Hawajui ninachofanya mi
Bwa mdogo
Bwana mdogo
Bwa mdogo
Nikitema na shiba
Bwa mdogo
Bwana mdogo
Bwa mdogo
Kilimanjaro napanda mi
Bwa mdogo
Bado Bwana mdogo Shara, ndege wanashangilia, na nitakupeleka Ulaya. Wivu umewaingia, Mungu kanionyesha ishara. Ndege wanashangilia, na nitakupeleka Ulaya. Wakiniona wananiita
kwa mdogo,
bwana mdogo,
kwa mdogo.
Hawajui ninachofanya mimi
kwa mdogo,
bwana mdogo,
kwa mdogo.
Nikitema na shiba
kwa mdogo,
bwana mdogo. Jaro na panda mi Bado bwana mdogo
yeah, nobody will yet. But the door be and nobody will yet. Nobody will yet, yeah, nobody will yet.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Eagle, producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a wealthy man will always have followers. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.